Yeah, that's kind of unfortunate. I never give enough time to the final testing period. So I try to space them like that so I feel like I'm ahead of the target and I'm not still running behind. Whatever's on the calendar is not necessarily the truth, though.
Feel free to slow down.
I have a really great video. It's really a great one, and it was put out, I didn't know who it was put out for, many years, and I caught it off of PBS, and finally after, with the invention of the internet, I thought, well, the right search engine, you could find these things, and it turned out Brigham Young University is one who made it and was still selling it, so I bought a better copy of it. It's a recreation of the Constitutional Convention, and much of it deals with the legislative fight over Virginia plan, New Jersey plan. But the reason I love it is because it gives all the different factions and feelings and arguments between large state, small state, rural, northern, southern, etc., which we tend to gloss over, but the movie does such a good job of showing how it could have just as easily not come to be if it wouldn't be a constitution. And some semesters I show it and some I don't. I used to coach a quiz bowl program at Northside and have to be gone extra nights. That's over with now. I have to do that now because I don't have to miss as many as I used to. So when I have shown that program, but then we'd fall behind, I'd be racing to lecture, and then other times I wish I'd shown it. So if we, and you're not much of a participatory class, I mean, in a bad sense. I mean, you smile a lot at my weak jokes, and that means a lot, so I appreciate that. But since you don't bring up a lot of current events discussions, we may race a little faster than normal, and that would give us the chance to watch that video, if you'd like. You wouldn't be disappointed. It's pretty good.
Give us after the first test and we might start.
It's one of those things where after the first test you would really, really appreciate more because you'd know everything in the video, but then it would also be, well, if I'd seen this video before the test, I could have got that question and touched on. So.
Oh, I'm going to talk
more. Oh, okay. Talking more. I hope we don't have this thing where after the first test people just run away and disappear. Can do that? That doesn't have to happen. We can all ace this test. We can make that commitment together.
Right. Still in a mild state of panic over the quizzes.
Well, maybe you'll find the tests easier because they are multiple choice and matching, so you have a word bank to work with, or a phrase bank to work with.
Just seeing
it in print
with
Bill
Clinton.
And your
open book, right?
Do
so love an
optimist. Well, I'll give you a Bill Clinton answer. I wouldn't necessarily rule it out on one of the tests coming up. That might happen. So which aisle are we on here?
Open note.
That's even more. That's the real book. Because the note is 14. Thank you. So, in my, I don't know why I do this, I just feel compelled to kind of like quickly just say a few things about what we last left at, maybe because it means that the new stuff has some balance. But the Articles of Confederation are just almost always looked at as this failure. In fact, the historian John Fisk, who's not on a quiz or a test, so I don't feel like I can write it down, but John Fisk, who wrote in the 1880s and 1890s, was quite negative about it, argued that it was a critical period in American history where had we not made it out of, that his explanations were that the country would have fallen apart into warring states, or could have been warring states over like boundaries, trade restrictions, etc., and that it would have been an easy pickings for England to come back and take part of or all of it. And so the John Fisk view, again from the 1880s, is that those who gathered together and established a new constitution are as much to be celebrated as heroes as those who won the revolution because they saved the revolution through the creation of the constitution. We'll look at another author a few years after that who has a total different view of that. But the reasons that that's the more popular view is because usually we talk about the failures of the Articles rather than the successes. And maybe to some of you, I heard an interview on TV, who was it? One of the Bush officials was being asked by CNN lady about you promoted the concept of smaller government or little government, but when is little government too little in regards to things like hurricane relief? And he didn't really respond, and I didn't probably listen either. I just thought the question was more important than the answer, because that's where we started, was with this almost sacred belief in little government and fear of big, strong national government. And with the Constitution, we enlarged a bit, not completely, but a bit of the government, and then it just kind of crept and grew throughout the 20th century, the New Deal, Great Society, et cetera. And there was that turning back of the largeness of government after the 70s and 80s. But this is the growth period, when they start off cautiously with limited government in the Articles. And of course, as I said, it's perceived to have failed. But I think that it's important to understand that much of what was in the Articles wasn't completely thrown out. The idea of separate states having sovereign powers is taken from that. The idea in item 8 about having a national citizenship and to have, in essence, almost full faith and credit, they had that then, where your property records, your court records would be honored by another state. If you move from one state to another, you had all the citizenship rights. So there is a great accomplishment out of the Articles. Now, another, I don't know if I went over this with you or not, but they mentioned that the state of New York mandates one day a year for all public schools, or one class period, I guess, per year, where history classes have to examine to what degree the Articles of Confederation is based on the Iroquois Confederation model. No, that's definitely New York state law in public schools. Why do you think that's there? I've always been uncomfortable when the state mandates you must teach a certain concept, although it didn't teach it as truth, it taught it as to what degree is it true, so they give you a chance to analyze. But why would a state do that?
State of Arkansas makes you take Arkansas history, right?
But what if it made you take an Arkansas history in which it analyzed to what degree was the Quapaw Nation responsible for state government? What would be the purpose of...
They were the first people in that state anyway, and the way that they lived had bearing on...
Did it? There's the real question, did it? You put together two things right away that the state of New York wanted done. Recognize who was the original owners of the land. So that concept is brought forward. Then the second question is the implication that if it may be true, then it may be true. From a confederation, we know the Iroquois Confederation was an on and off again ally of the British, talked about that in the French and Indian War. Do you think political systems that a majority of English-based citizens had was more influenced from their English roots or from their experience of being independent states wanting to be free of parliamentary tyranny, or because they had close enough relations with Iroquois allies that they modeled a political system after them? Well, I'm not an expert on answering it, so I shouldn't have brought it up like that, but my first perspective is this is how powerful the current Iroquois nation still can lobby New York politics in order to mandate the study of themselves for the purposes we're talking about. Even if you come up with a conclusion, maybe not very influential, what did the exercise pressure you to do? To make you think about diversity and respect of different cultures. So I think that's exciting. Think about the politics that's woven into the history studies.
Is there anything in Arkansas like that as far as this?
I am so ignorant of Arkansas history. I like the president of the press conference, I'd be on to the next question on that one. I really don't know. I don't know at all. There probably is. Yeah. So we talked about this, in fact, this area of where you re-examine the role and the place of people who've been left out of the story. Especially if you like use new titles. What is this called? Have we already been through this or not? Well, let's say if, for example, here's a serious movement being contemplated in social studies and history circles to stop using the phrase minorities when talking about various factions of the American population, instead to use the phrase members of the world's majorities. He didn't mention that? Or to stop using the phrase slaves and instead say enslaved persons?
It's all because everybody's trying to be politically correct. And
that's the phrase I'm looking for.
Yes,
and you say it so disgustedly.
Because there's a time
and place.
Yeah. When you're talking about something in history, I mean, it's kind of one of those things to where that's how they said it
okay.
at that time. Why try to change things up?
Well, exactly why I'm bringing that up. Why might we want to change? If it for a long time was called Pontiac's conspiracy, which it was.
It's called Pontiac's uprising.
Who conspired here? Conspiracy suggests that somebody pulled a fast one on us when they should have known we were the rightful folk to be there. That implies no acknowledgement of the title of the land for Pontiac and the Shawnee. The change to rebellion and uprising gives a little more. Even today, you know, in political circles, look at the way the news media has struggled with such things as terrorists, insurgents, freedom fighters, militants, trying to find terminology that doesn't convey some type of political message, or does. Example being Fox TV, doesn't, maybe they do now, but for a long time they would not use suicide bomber. What phrase would they use? Homicide bomber. There's a definite political message being communicated there. And so I just say this because if you compare history books of different things in the past, subtle differences in language can really convey a different meaning. Oh, it's definitely changing. It's changing up the political values being ascribed to it. It's kind of where I'm going with this. We don't use Indian that much anymore. Instead, we use what? In Canada, when I was visiting Vancouver a few years back, I went into the college bookstore up there, and in their section on different subjects for textbooks, they didn't have a Native American section. They had a First Nations section. Still carries similar connotation. So.
But I'm still sure.
Not vertically challenged.
Still about vertically challenged.
Well, I mean, there's two sides to the PC argument. One is, it's why do we have to be nice to people all the time, which I think is a good thing. You know? But then the other side, the more insidious side, the side that conservatives argue is the left-wing McCarthyism, is this actual attempt to try to change values, change attitudes by creating new shame somewhere else and taking off old shame somewhere before. And I think that's true. I think there is left-wing McCarthyism. I'm a left-winger. I see Arkell doing it on purpose. There is a trying to rewrite things, and that's why this movement to try to say to what degree was the Articles Confederation a product of the Iroquois Confederation role model, I think very little, but it's an agenda at work there. Weaknesses and failures of the article. Back to this. Well, it lacked an executive, number 14 here, lacked an executive and judicial branch, which is pretty important stuff to be missing. If, for example, two colonies, not colonies in the United States, that's for me. I had the hardest time after 1776 moving from colonies to states, and after 1947, I kind of remember there's no more War Department. It's Defense Department. I still think more, because I spend more time lecturing it one way than the other. But anyway, the lack of executive and judicial branches are critical, or the need for is critical. If you had two states that got into a debate over boundaries, let's say the boundaries of a river, and the river shifts, this has actually happened in world history before, the river would shift, and sandbars appear in between the old and the new riverbeds, and then gold appears, and then people on both sides claim it's their gold and start shooting each other over it. Who adjudicates in that respect? Back in the 60s, nobody would. Whoever had the bigger gun, I guess, would. And if you had, like, for instance, when they worked together for the war effort, fortunately, they did work together for the war effort. But who would be the person that would give orders and be a commander-in-chief if there hadn't been somebody like the character of Washington that was somewhere else? No one, because of that. So why would they build a government that was so inefficient that lacked a chief executive and a judiciary branch? That's right. The fear of tyranny answer. That's the answer to each one of these things. So it may look like a mistake, but it is considered a cautious guard against something worse centralized tyranny or monarchy. It also lacked national compulsive power, which we've already mentioned. States couldn't be forced to really comply with anything, even if it had been voted on measure by the Continental Congress. There was no way to implement the will. It had to be voluntary. Very important was the national government lacked the authority, or the Continental Congress lacked the authority to tax or regulate trade. And we could add to that, after the war was over, to coin money of any value that mattered. Why would taxing, trade regulation, and coining be something denied? Well, it's so much because money power is the real power of the purse, as they say. And so therefore, that was retained at the state levels. It underwent diplomatic failures, too. Two ways, item 15 would show. Remember that the British did not evacuate the Great Lakes forts. Now, there were some multiple reasons we can explain this by. The reasons given by the British are what? Fur trading. Well, that's not the real reason. That's the real reasons, not the ones given.
You
know.
Didn't pay for the war, so
it was safe. Yeah, you still owe merchant debts, and you haven't restored confiscated land to the loyalists, and so until those two things are taken care of, we feel no obligation to leave the forts, which they felt pretty comfortable, the British felt pretty comfortable they would never be taken care of, so they never have to leave the forts. Mm-hmm. For the reasons that you mentioned, is the lucrative trade arrangement, as well as the fear that if Americans became a bit bumptious and aggressive and tried to take Canada, why have to leave so many important British troops in Canada if you can have armed Indians do it for you? And so that's what the British did, was arm those Native Americans that were in the Northwest Territory area. They would serve to, reciprocate with the fur trade, but they'd also serve to be a barrier against any Americans that might move in and become a threat. And Americans did speak of, talk about, flirt with the invasion of Canada until about 1840s. All the way into the 1840s, there was always that kind of a perceived idea that sea to shining sea means also pole to pole at some point in Canada would be. And, you know, still to this day in high school, about two classes out of every six or seven, somebody's always wanting to invade Canada. And I don't think it's a joke. I think they're so serious when they say it. And I will say to them, you know, Canadians think we talk like that. Don't even joke like that. And then they'll say, we're not joking. But it was something that the British seriously worried about in these early days of the new nation, and that's why they wanted to arm the Indians as well as the fur trade.
Why haven't they ever?
Because we're allies. And we weren't strong enough in the early years. During the War of 1812, there was a great attempt to try to do so. But I'd say, luckily for all contained, we couldn't do it until we finally woke up and realized we didn't need to. Some treaties we'll look at later. We do have the longest non-fortified border with Canada that any two nations have, which is a good sign. So we were unable to get the British to leave the forts because we didn't have a strong enough central government to make them honor that commitment. Also, it was impossible to unify together for common trade agreements. With each state allowed the authority to regulate trade as they would wish. Tariffs were charged upon each of the 13 states by different European nations, and often it would work this way. The Europeans would work the states against each other. They'd say, like France would say, and England would say, you can't trade in our market without paying high taxes, and we won't let you trade in our market unless you guarantee we don't have to pay any tariffs into your market. And if you don't like it, we'll trade with your neighbor, not you. So that inability to have one standard trade regulatory power was a major weakness and failure of the colonies. And to some degree, it's mindful of the more current argument. But what's the arrangement now to try to group North America, at least, and maybe even Central America, for that matter, into a one unified trade body? NAFTA, and some speak of CAFTA. And of course, what's the arguments that, especially those who are factory workers, often make about it? What's wrong with NAFTA? Because it causes jobs to go where the economy is not as healthy. Same argument made among the 13 states originally, that they would see their businesses shrink off in another direction unless they were to be protectionist. As item 16 shows, there was an effort made by the Continental Congress to try it. One particular treaty was a really hard fixed desire to make one national trade agreement with Spain. And that is that we would give Spain a completely, Spain would give us complete access to the markets with no tariffs on any of the 13 states if the United States would promise to stop using the Port of New Orleans. Let's talk a little bit about that. The Port of New Orleans was continually throughout history vitally necessary as the watershed of all the rivers, and so most of your Westerners, just barely west of the Appalachians, needed the Mississippi as a way, as port of deposit to get their products out. If such a treaty had gone through, which it didn't, it did not muster the necessary vote to pass, two-thirds vote. If it had passed, who would have gained, who would have lost in that arrangement? Spain definitely would have gained twice, because they would have gotten the trade anyway. But Spain would have been there, because Spain at this point in time was the ones who felt most threatened by the presence of Americans. That what would happen is these American trappers and fur traders, et cetera, that would go down these rivers, it would be quite a long trip from the beginning all the way to New Orleans by the time they get to New Orleans, and get paid and get tanked up after they get paid and shoot up the town and talk about how someday this will all be American. It upset Spanish, and so they felt like in order to prevent this kind of expansionist attitudes, we just need to get a final agreement to keep them out of the port. So it would have, had it gone through, the Spanish would have secured a better hold over the river in New Orleans. It's still got an American trade, but the people who would have lost out on this would have been the Westerners, and the people who would have gained in America are the Eastern traders, Eastern seaboard. So it's back to that. The Eastern seaboard elite folk would get a good trade agreement, and who would it be but the frontier Piedmont people who would end up paying the price for it. So that's back in that theme that we talked about with the regulator movement, the Paxton Boys, and the Bacon's Rebellion. And thinking of that, that was a while back when we had that. You'll remember all that kind of stuff at the test, right? Good. That was a firm hell yes, not just yes. Can memorize all those facts and remember them. So anyway, the Jay Gardoqui Treaty, which failed, would have benefited Eastern Seaboard Elite at the expense of Western farmers. The treaty didn't go through because it couldn't muster the two-thirds vote, but it did send the signal to Westerners that if the power base is still the Eastern Seaboard, and they could have made, if there had been a simple majority vote to get measures passed, it would have passed. So that's one of the reasons today our Constitution set up that treaties must be ratified by a two-thirds vote. It was to protect particular geographic sections from other sections making treaties to the disadvantage of others. When I was speaking about 15, about the problems of unfair trade agreements, and I mentioned France playing one state off against the other, did that bring to mind any thinking here? Well, what were the provisions of the Franco-American Treaty of Alliance after Saratoga? Both stay in the fight until the other's willing to quit, no separate negotiations, and?
Free trade,
no barriers. So what's France done here? Negotiated separate with England and Spain, and we caught them at the last minute and had to make our own cut and run. And now here they are not offering free trade. So the French, I'm not trying to French bash here, we get a lot of that all the time, but in this particular situation, the French violated both aspects of the treaty. And then we'll see later during the French Revolution, they come to us and say, we need to come help them because we're obligated by treaty. We'll see that coming up. On the next page, 17, looks like I've already waded into and talked about this. One thing I can add, though, is in addition to Europeans playing one state off against each other, so did the states themselves. So say, for example, New York had a thriving, make this up here, olive crop and a fledgling wheat crop. In Pennsylvania, the neighbor had the reverse. Each would put tariffs on each other's threatened product in order to make their farmers protected, but that also means for everybody consuming, there's unnecessary high taxes being paid by everybody to do business across state lines. So once again, that ability to regulate trade being retained at the state level hurt business commerce domestically and internationally. Another problem that the articles experienced was the unpaid war debt. And as I said before, some in the neighborhood of almost $72 million was owed to individual citizens, foreign countries, by both the National Congress as well as each state. And to raise that kind of money was not going to happen just through land sales. And as long as the war debt remained unpaid, it was difficult to gain the trust of investors and foreign investors until the first debt was paid off. Numerous attempts to try to give the Continental Congress the power to tax were taken. Each time they voted to try to amend the authority, that every vote failed. They then attempted a requisition system, which is in essence kind of like what PBS does on telethons. It's play a Clapton concert and beg for the money. And works for them, didn't work for the Continental Congress. So they were in deep debt problems and unable to raise the money necessary to pay it. 20, we've already done 19. 20 is also another feature we need to know about here, and that is, I think we spoke earlier about the post-French and Indian War situation that I mentioned, that most post-war circumstances are one of recessionary times. Well, we have another post-war circumstance. Post-Revolutionary War was quite deflationary. But the power to coin money existed at each state level, so different states would print more or less amounts of money to try to cope with the economic problem. Which meant from first glance, you know, there's going to be an instability of currency. Even though the Continental Congress may have been empowered to say, we're all going to use dollars, or we're all going to use ounces and pounds, etc. In the money situation, a Pennsylvania dollar, and a New York dollar, and a Virginia dollar does not mean a dollar. It means whatever you know the exchange rate of the worth is. And so a lack of stability on money occurred when some states inflated with more paper money than others. So it depended on who had the ability to take over the legislatures. In some states, debtors took over the legislature and printed paper money, inflated it. In some states, the creditor class kept control. In item 21, this event occurred in Massachusetts. Creditors kept control of the Massachusetts legislature. And with a tight money policy, a number of Western farmers saw down the road foreclosures on their farms and loss of property. So in December of 1786 through January of 1787, a Revolutionary War veteran named Daniel Shays, last name is plural, and Daniel Shays led a rebellion of farmers who wanted to march on the banks and find all the property records and tear them up so nobody would have any debts. So this now is exactly what John Adams had said the revolution is not. This was a social class uprising as opposed to just a free freedom from Britain. Or at least this particular incident spoke of that. And it had the markings of what we said earlier. Western farmers feeling abused by Eastern seaboard elite. It was quelled, it was put down, but it sent signals to a lot of the property class individuals in the other states that the weakness of the Articles of Confederation is leading to bloodshed. Now, when Jefferson heard about this, yes?
So when the debtors controlled legislature, they printed more money. Mm-hmm. When the creditors controlled legislature, they didn't print any more money, or maybe even destroyed
some. Well, yeah, probably contracted it.
Okay.
They wouldn't necessarily want to contract money because that leads to heavy recession, but they didn't want to see their holdings become worthless by more printed paper money. And that's a struggle that goes on from American history all the way up until finally it becomes standard policy to do that under FDR in the 30s. That's when the national government starts to embrace the idea of removing away from step by step the gold standard and printing more and more money, which does deflate its value, but does help debtors to a point. Well, as I mentioned, that the certain property individuals, especially some of the prominent revolutionary leaders, are looking at this incident, and through a series of unrelated meetings start to bring these issues up and talk about them. Item 22 includes two of those meetings. 1785, representatives of Virginia and Maryland met at Mount Vernon at the home of Washington for what was called the Alexandria Conference. Original purpose of the meeting was to discuss how to redredge out and make the Potomac River a little more navigable for business. But they got sidetracked off the river discussion and instead was speaking of the problems we talked about in regards to inability to regulate trade and the debt that was piling up and can't get the British out of the forts. So all the weaknesses and problems of the articles dominate the discussion. And so they decide, how about a year from now, let's invite people from other states, have another conference, and get more serious about this. So in 1786 at Annapolis, Maryland, another conference is held, and this one is attended by five states attend, and one of the prominent voices that makes himself well known is New York Representative Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton had been an aide-de-camp to Washington during the Revolutionary War, and Hamilton had always urged Washington to consider, after the war, creating a strong centralized government with him as King George I. And Hamilton said, you become King George I, and I'll be your first Lord of the Treasury, and we'll make this country rich and work. He said that all the time during the Revolutionary War. So now at this conference, he urges not only Washington, but others to seriously consider revising the articles, is the phrase used. Revise the articles and create a government that is more functional. Well, when word of this reaches the Continental Congress, it's discussed very cautiously, because when you talk about amending or revising the government, less politically correct words would sound like what? Treason, overthrow, coup d'etat, that's good. But also the need for changes were obvious. So they discussed this, and finally the Continental Congress authorized a meeting for the revisement as long as it was understood that they are only able to amend, not to throw out and start over. That was a direct order of the Continental Congress, and it was also most of the states, when they sent delegates, that was the authorization that the state legislature said. You were not there to overthrow the government. Throw it all out and dare to amend and fix one that exists. Of course, what they do is they throw it out and build a new one, just like they're told not to. That meeting occurs in the summer of 1787, from May through September. I've got September there, but it should say May through September. Delegates from 12 of the 13 states come. Rhode Island will not send people. They're totally opposed to it. Some were members of state legislatures. Some were actual members of the Continental Congress. Others were not. Each state made its own arrangements for what was an authorized delegate. There had to be at least three delegates from a state before it could agree to and sign a measure. All of the people who came were of the bourgeois merchant class. Most of them were lawyers. And this is where I bring in this book that's listed in 25 now. If John Fiske, back in the 1880s, wrote of this convention as a rescue of the revolution, describing these people as demigods, half deity and half human, Charles Beard takes quite a different approach to this. He's writing a book that was published in 1913. My underlining shifted over there. The name of the book is An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution. Before we get into exactly what his theme is, let's talk a little bit about the political climate around 1913. In the first two decades of the 20th century, there is a reform movement going on. Anybody familiar with the name of it? Allows women to vote, it outlaws liquor, it changes the Senate to direct election, regulates child labor. Known as the Progressive Reform Era. So, the first of the major reform eras of the 20th century. Progressivism was considered kind of, I guess, liberal for that time period. And the term progressive, by the way, has come back. It's popular, isn't it? When people claim, I'm a progressive, what is that? They're not 1913 Charles Beard progressives. They're cowardly liberals. They're people who won't admit they're a New Dealer or a Great Society liberal because they can't get elected if they say that. So instead they claim, I'm not a liberal, I'm not a conservative, I'm a progressive. Well, progressives were all gone by 1918, 1920. So that's another attempt at political correctness here in order to soften the load. But in the progressive period, maybe the way to help explain the climate and the feelings of this is the 19th century, 1800 to 1900, is a period of great patriotic zeal about America. Historians, even critics, are not critical of the whole country itself. They're critical of aspects, things like anti-slavery movement. And so there is this kind of understood feeling, like Fisk had enunciated, that there was nothing wrong with the Constitutional Convention. It was a rescue of the Revolution. But by the end of the century, maybe because of the influence of Karl Marx's thinking, maybe Darwinism and science and everything, that there was this great skepticism that began to creep into scholarly works. And during this progressive reform period, the first 20 years, 1900 to 1920, historians began to experiment with the idea that, well, let's look for just as, I'm not a Marxist and I don't want to necessarily teach Marxism, but it'll help explain Beard. Marx would argue that society and history is based on a constant struggle of those who have power and economic resources and those who do not. One displaces another, and then eventually another group comes along who is out of power that displaces the empowered. Whether it's kings and slaves, eventually it's capitalists, and then it's workers, etc. And haves versus have-nots tends to be the Marxist view of history. So if progressive reformers are flirting with Marxist thinking, and they go back to thinking about this Constitutional Convention, how might they see the people who threw out the Articles and rebuilt the Constitution? Why might they have done it? With the Shays Rebellion hanging there as an argument. Yes. If we say the American Revolution was a conservative revolution that allowed the property people to stay on top when it was over and those who were poor still were poor, then the uprisings against the Articles could be perceived as the real social revolution, and then this is what they want to stop. And that's what Beard argued in 1913, was that these people were the top elite who saw their properties threatened, and what they really did was a counter-revolution to skim off a social economic revolt. Beard is also said to have put property records, and I looked at it, I didn't understand them, at the back of the book, that showed that after the revolution was over, they had all gained much more wealth and profits, bond holdings as a result of the years following the Constitution. Which a historian in the 50s named Forrest MacDonald looked up and said was totally fabricated. He just lied. No proof at all to property records. It doesn't necessarily make the theory wrong, but it's not as persuasive an argument when you cut the books like that. But it was a popular thinking in the first two decades that if it's haves versus have-nots, then the people who came to the Constitutional Convention were the haves who wanted to make sure. And of course, that's where, you know, someone could say that when I mentioned in 24 that all were bourgeois and all were lawyers, like that's a new thing. Like that isn't true for the whole story we've been studying here. But that's what Beard would argue. Beard would also argue that the fact that the convention was held in total secrecy with a press ban was a conspiracy to make things ready and put forward for acceptance without any argument or debate by others. Beard also argued if you look at the way the government was rebuilt, much power was taken from the states and shifted up to the national level, to where only the top elite would have a voice. And there's this argument to be made in that connection, or at least to be pondered, is under the Articles, most power was at the state level, right? And most power at state level were legislators. Governors were weak at the state level. Judges were weak at the state level. And these legislatures were directly elected by the people, or at least directly elected by the white males and the property owners of the right church. When you shift power to the Constitution the way you know, think about it now. Oh, well, not now. Think about it when it was ratified in 1787, 1789. How much of the national government would be directly popularly elected? 1/6, right? What part would be nationally elected by popular vote? House of Representatives. How was the Senate up until 1913 selected? State legislatures were empowered to elect senators, not common voters. I mean, how was the president selected? And for that matter, technically still is today. Electors chosen by a state, not popular vote. How are judges, as we're watching right now, selected? President appointment with who ratifying or confirming? What part of Congress? That at that time was selected by state legislatures. So in the beginning, 5/6 of the national government was not in the hands of the people, only 1/6. Compare that back to the Articles of Confederation. If most of the power used to be at the state level, most of the powers were in the legislatures, elected by people, you see a real shift. Well, three branches, if you consider all three branches in the court. If the courts are worth 1/3, the Congress and the presidency are each worth 1/3. Let's see that way. So just in terms of who gets to make policy, who gets to select those that do make policy? What used to be much more in the hands of the common voters quickly shifted up to our elite, is what Beard would argue. Also another, yes?
So isn't
Marxism, which turned into the political philosophy of communism, was built around the belief that all resources should be by the state, by force, shared equally rather than. So that arguing that the haves always get it in a way to protect the have-nots. Not that it was a successful workable philosophy, but it was a century ago, so trying to figure things out. So that was the secrecy, who attended, how power was restructured, how money power was changed. Because prior to this, who regulated trade, who coined money? And taxed states. After the creation of a federal government, the authority to coin money and therefore stabilize currency shifted to the national level, taken from the states. International trade given to the national government. Authority to tax given to the national government. So money power definitely shifted up to, if you work on the argument that the elite empowered themselves only, then every power granted can be used as a good argument. Well, as exciting as that may be to try to claim our founding fathers were really into it for themselves, that's not the way this historian in 26 looked at it. Henry Steele Commager, a fierce liberal of the 1960s and 70s, like just today would call himself a progressive. Commager argued this. That's not the way to be looking at these founding fathers. That's letting doctrinaire political thinking ignore the reality of what happened historically. He would say this. He did say this. Why did they gather? They gathered to fix the problem of how do you make a government more efficient without being too tyrannical. If they had been in it for their own profit's sake, and I like this argument Thomas makes, if you were a business person, bothered by increasing British red tape, paperwork, and taxes, you had two choices on how to improve your business circumstance. One, pay the taxes and gripe and cuss about it. Two, start a revolution that you could lose because you're the weakest resistance force on the planet and be executed and have your property expropriated and your family killed too. What's the wise business decision for profit? So clearly, paying the taxes and cussing about it would be a much greater strategy for making profits. So since most of the people who restructured the Constitution were revolutionary leaders to start with, let's go back and ask the motives of the revolution. Were they, Beard would have said yes, but Commager said, were they truly in the revolution for just profit? Kalmager concludes, no. He concludes that it was an idealistic fight for rights, for liberties, for a fair and just government. So if we can conclude that they were sincere in the revolt, we can assume that they are watching their experiment fall apart and they're concerned with making it work right. And that brings us back to that first statement. They're there not for personal conspiratorial greed. They're there to fine-tune a system, but not create tyranny. And he says, that's why the creation of three branches of government and a federal and state split was such a good answer to what they came up with. By creating three different branches that check and balance each other, and by dividing power or keeping the division of power between state and national government with defined powers and limits on power, that's what they gathered to do, and that's what they accomplished. And as for the secrecy part of it, which is down in 28, it's mindful of this, that Woodrow Wilson, president in 1913 through 1921, he put forth a peace proposal to try to get World War I finished called the 14 Points. And the first point of the 14 Points was open covenants arrived at openly, which meant that treaties between nations need to be in the press and in front of the people at all times. So, because the argument was that secret alliances and secret treaties had dragged all these nations into World War I before they knew what had happened. So if all the negotiations had to be done in the open, where the people could see what's happening, it would all be more fair and just and efficient. But even at the World War I conference, the doors were shut and reporters were kept out, and so it wasn't as openly arrived at as idealistic Wilson would have wanted, because sometimes people have to advance extreme positions to negotiate back a middle ground. So that's where Kalmager would argue the secrecy didn't necessarily mean a conspiracy. It was just a more efficient way to get things done so people could speak their hearts and minds. And Kalmager also made this argument, when it was all finished and they came up with the Constitution, it still had to be ratified by states. And each state could choose through either legislative or a convention method how to ratify it, which meant that a majority of the people who elect these legislators, you know, delegates to conventions, would have a voice to ratify or not. So if the people are getting tricked, they vote it out. That's what he'd argue. Well, that's just one of the places where historians like to argue back and forth what was the motives of the framers who built the Constitution. Let's get into what's inside the Constitution. Did they tell you this stuff was cool? This is probably my favorite part of all pre-Civil War material. I hope you're not thinking, gosh, this is boring, and this is as good as it gets. I'm gone, you know, after this person's knowledge. Well, it's... How can you be cool?
It's just cold
in here. Let me do what my wife does when I let her play. She goes, when I turn the air conditioner on, it's cold outside. We're not outside. 102 outside, it's pretty cold. Well, this is a bundle of very successful compromises. That's what that video I have emphasizes. How many different factions and interest groups were reluctant to agree to change? Or if they wanted to change, it's one that they hope to benefit their interests. And any change that benefits one's interest usually is not a win-win circumstance. It's going to come at someone else's expense. So here are the various factions that all come to this convention girded for a fight. North, South, East, West, merchant class, rural areas, and of course, obviously, large plantation versus small yeoman farmer, although that last element's probably not very well represented at the delegates. The biggest fight that consumed most of the time that summer was what kind of legislature would replace the Continental Congress. Now this is because prior to the 20th century there was a theory about government that even if you split government into separate branches, legislative, executive and judicial, if you really want to protect against tyranny, you've got to give a lot of extra power to a legislature. That a legislature is the safest place to reposit more power. It's called the Whig theory of government. It comes from English politics. where they wanted to control the monarch and increase the power of parliament. So they recognized, and the Whig theory was as prominent in the colonies, all the, as I said before, all the states had created strong legislatures and weak governors and weak court systems. So whatever kind of legislature, whatever Congress has created, is the most important thing to protect your interests as well as protect against tyranny. Looking at the model of the Articles of Confederation Congress, each state had an equal voice, large state, small state, which for small states were great, because it means their interest is protected. But larger states argued it's not fair representation. If you have six times as many people in Virginia as you do Rhode Island, but they both have equal voice in the legislature, that means, in essence, Rhode Island is six times more valuable, more important people than Virginians. Of course, that's not the way Rhode Islanders wanted to look at it. And what we're trying to get at is an attitude in this time period where did they identify as citizens of a nation, or did they identify as wrangling states defending interests against each other? And a parallel that I've used for years, which maybe is outdated, but one I saw early on, was when I first started teaching at Northside back in the 70s. They had an arrangement where student body would nominate and sports teams would vote on select or vice versa, depending on what sports teams and student body would be two separate groups that would nominate and then vote on homecoming dates and clean. And I remember asking one of the fellow social studies department people why that was set up that way. And I said, was that just because since it is like football homecoming or basketball homecoming, they want to have the teams involved? They said, no, not at all. That's not the reason. The reason is the sports team has, at least in the late 70s when I started teaching them, sports team has a disproportionate larger number of minorities on it than does the student body. Therefore, in the selection process, there will be some African-American maids or a queen selected. Because if it was all student body nominate, all student body vote, at that time period, the much larger percentage of white students would select all white faces for the court. So that's how I kind of see a parallel to this situation, that did you identify as a member of population whole, or do you see yourselves as members of a state? It's quite easy if you are a member of a majority culture, a large state, to say we should all be represented as equal people. Each person should be the same vote, one person, one vote. But if the way voting turns out, a certain group never gets representation, if small states or rural states, they saw none of the benefits of lawmaking, why be in such a system? So there's the problem is, how did people identify? As members of a large population or as members of a small state wanting to protect their interests? And it was addressing that problem that they had to go for. Now, the role model of bicameral legislatures, which means two-house legislatures, came from two sources. Parliament, obviously, the House of Lords and the House of Commons, but also, I believe, although I'm telling the truth when I say this, I believe all 13 state legislatures are two-house legislatures, too. If not all, almost all were. And I know that what I've read about that is the two-house legislatures in the colonies, before they became states, usually was based on one house as a lower house started legislation, a next house, which originally was an advisory body to governors and expanded more people, could carry on or kill legislation, and then finally a governor would pass it. So there was this clear lower and upper house arrangement. Lower houses tended to be more open to the common people voting, who had less property. Upper houses tended to be more higher social status, which was somewhat similar to the British Parliament. So there was a concept at work here of having upper and lower houses. Two different plans were put forward in item 30 and item 31. The Virginia plan, also known as the large state plan, and the New Jersey plan, also known as the small state plan. Let's define both here. Virginia, obviously, a large populated state, wants to give advantage to proportional representation. So their argument was, create a two-house legislature, that way you have a check and balance, and have both houses be proportional. There would be an executive and judiciary branch, but both would be selected by this legislature. So in some ways, it'd be like parliament. But the ministers and judges are all selected by parliamentary selection, not by popular vote outside of the parliament. Strongly Whig theory-based legislative power here. Small states weren't amused. They say, what is the value of a second legislature that is still proportional? It's like running the Florida votes through four or five times with the same machines. If you don't hand count them, you're going to come up with the same vote. So they disagreed with that arrangement. They proposed in the small state plan a Congress similar to the existing Continental Congress, where each state had one representative, equal vote. They did postulate a separate, more empowered executive and judicial branch, although their select how it would be selected was not clear. So there you see it. It is the fight between, do we think as numbers of people, or do we fight as protecting ourselves as a given state? The Great Compromise, or Connecticut Compromise, in item 32 was, after a lot of wrangling, what they came up to, what they voted on, which creates what we have today. A House of Representatives that's proportional. A Senate where each state has equal vote, two, not one, two senators. And in this process, the Senate would be considered and deemed the upper house. Which gives me a chance for a couple of questions, which we may not get answered before we go, but we can start flirting with the answers, and maybe we can spend some time at home thinking about them coming back. Here's my two questions. If the Senate is the upper house, is it because I just said so, or is there evidence and proof that makes being in the Senate more powerful and more prestigious? And if we can conclude, which we will once I manipulate the discussion, that the Senate is the upper house, then why would the large states agree to giving the more powerful body favorable to the small states? And it can't be just because I get along where I always give an in. There's got to be some kind of a trade-off here. So let's fight the first one down a little while, because we still got some time there. Anything about the Senate that you could say, yes, that's an example of why it is a more prestigious body and thus could be deemed as the higher upper house? With two, what does that mean right away? Yeah. So less people, more important. When you watch the Senate hearings, you are likely to recognize most of the names on the Judiciary Committee, because with only 100 senators, most senators are going to be on some committee and be better heard of than me, where you can hear name after name of the 435 congressperson, you still never have heard a lot of them. So yes, more visibility, more voice, more power diffused among less people, which is back to that Whig theory that the reason the legislature was a good place to give power anyway is more people diffuse power, and the Senate had less people, so more power among smaller numbers. What else? In some degrees. For right now, those who know where I'm going, don't steal my punchline. Let me just make this comment. Actually, bills can start in either house as long as they get through the other house identically. Now, there's an exception to that, so I'll give it away, because that's going to be my punchline later. Yes, that's going to be this. But in theory, bills started in one house can start in either house and get through as long as you get through an identical form. So it's not just that it's always the finish. It's like it's not the upper house in terms of bills always going up that way. What did we say about when we're talking about Beard's argument that it was conspiratorial, and I made the mathematical statement that was challenged about 5/6 of the government being out of the hands of the common voter? Which house was in the hands of the common white male property owning church member voter? House of Representatives. So how was the Senate selected? State legislature. So right away, the Senate is also a step away in terms of who selects senators. How about age requirements? You have to be 30. Where in the House, you have to be how old? 25. So those 5 years may not make much difference to us now, but back when the lifespan was shorter, it made a much bigger difference that the people who are still alive at age 30, selected by a state legislature, were more likely to be prestigious, prominent folks. How long did they serve? 6 years. 6 years is a lot better than 2 years. 2 years, you're always running for re-election. 6 years, you can have a couple of Monica situations, and by the time you're running for re-election, I don't remember. But it is true that you get more entrenched as a senator, build up visibility, build up money base, donations base, etc. So 6 year is a much more powerful stint. Is there anything that the Senate gets to do that the House does not? John Roberts.
Judges.
Yes, they confirm judicial appointments. Anything else? Well, the impeachment share. The House draws up impeachment articles and the Senate tries them. I guess being the trials may be more prestigious.
There's no clear winner
of the House. Actually, it is. If there's no clear winner of the presidency, the House gets to do that, but if there's no clear winner of the vice president, the Senate gets to do that.
What about war?
Well, war is declared by both houses of Congress, but you're on the right track. Short of war, how do we sometimes negotiate things with other nations? Treaties, yes. So therefore, the ratification of treaties is something only the Senate does. And so far, for our could be upcoming quiz on what makes the Senate better or more powerful, we have the requirements to get there, that's longer term, 6 years, the ability to confirm appointments to the judiciary, the ratification of treaties, these are all things the Senate does, the House does not. Anything else? Well, other appointments fall under it. Cabinet positions, ambassadorial appointments, that's all something the Senate does. So with the greater visibility, longer terms, being older to get there, these added functions that the Senate performs, the House does not, are we making a good case that the Senate seems to be an upper house? Just maybe not as much as what the colonial situation are, but okay. So then the second question. Why would the large states agree to so much power be given to a body that favors small states? Besides, we just caved in to get a government. You're on. The money bills, yes. Taxing, coining, spending, that's the one exception to the thing I said before. They can only start in the House. While all other types of bills can start in either house and get through the other house in identical form, only the House has the authority to initiate money bills, spending, tax, and coining. And if power of the purse and money is power of government, that's a great counterbalance that the large states had a voice over. So putting this together, it would seem that we come from what, a small or large state? Small state, right, population-wise? So we would feel like, oh, the Senate protects our interests. And it might seem like New York and California or Texas, a large state population-wise, would feel like, oh, the House protects our interests. Do we, as Americans, feel that way? I don't think we do. What would that suggest? It worked. Yeah, it's a good compromise. Exactly. So, and that was the most important one. And we'll pick up more when we come back.